dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KFAR Knoxville 90.9, or Free Radio Olympia 91.3. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, the Republican National Convention invaded New York City like an occupying army. The city deployed nearly all its 40,000-person police force to keep demonstrators away from the convention. Demonstrations went on day after day, and there were almost 2,000 arrests. Aside from the general outrage at Bush administration policies, including the war in Iraq, city residents were angry because they believed the Republicans selected their city as a convention site in order to capitalize on the September 11th attacks. The speeches from the podium of the convention only confirmed the impression of the planned exploitation of the city's historic tragedy. A poll released on August 30th by the Zogby Organization showed that half, 49.3% of New York City residents and 41% of New York citizens overall say that some of our leaders knew in advance that attacks were planned on or around September 11, 2001, and that they consciously failed to act. The poll of New York residents was conducted from Tuesday, August 24th through Thursday, August 26th. The overall results have a margin of sampling error of 3.5%, according to the pollsters. The poll is the first of its kind conducted in America that surveys attitudes regarding U.S. government complicity in the 9/11 tragedy. Despite the acute legal and political implications of this accusation, nearly 30% of registered Republicans and over 38% of those who described themselves as very conservative supported the claim. The charge found very high support among adults under 30, 62.8%, among African Americans, 62.5%, among Hispanics, 60.1%, among Asians, 59.4%, and among born-again evangelical Christians, 47.9%. Less than 2 in 5, 36%, believe that the 9/11 Commission had answered all the important questions about what actually happened on September 11th. And 2 in 3, 66% of New Yorkers, and 56.2% overall, called for another full investigation of the still unanswered questions by Congress or Elliot Spitzer, New York's Attorney General. Self-identified very liberal New Yorkers supported a new inquiry by a margin of 3-1, but so did half, 53%, of very conservative citizens across the state. The call for a deeper probe was especially strong from Hispanics, 75.6%, African Americans, 75.3%, citizens with income from $15,000 to $25,000 a year, 74.3%, women, 62%, and evangelicals, 59.9%. W. David Kubiak, executive director of 911truth.org, the group that commissioned the poll, expressed genuine surprise that the New Yorkers' belief in the administration's complicity is as high or higher than seen overseas. We're familiar with high levels of 9/11 skepticism abroad, where there has been much open debate of the evidence for U.S. government complicity. On May 26, the Toronto Star reported a national poll showing that 63% of Canadians are also convinced U.S. leaders had prior knowledge of the attacks yet declined to act. There was no U.S. coverage of this startling poll or the facts supporting the Canadians' conclusions. and there has been virtually no debate on the victims' families' scores of still unanswered questions. I think these numbers show that most New Yorkers are now fed up with the silence, and that politicians trying to exploit 9/11 do so at their peril. The 9/11 case is not closed, and New York's questions are not going away. Close quote. Nicholas Levis of New York 9/11truth.org, an advisor on the poll, agrees. He said, "The 9/11 Commission gave us plenty of recommendations, but far more plentiful were the discrepancies, gaps, and omissions in their supposedly final report. How can proposals based on such deficient findings ever make us safe? We think these poll numbers are basically saying, wait just a minute, what about the sources of still outstanding questions? What about the unexplained collapses of World Trade Center 7, our air defenses, official accountability, the chain of command on 9/11, the anthrax, the insider trading, and the FBI field probes? There's so much more to this story that we need to know about." When such a huge majority of New Yorkers want a new investigation, it will be interesting to see how quickly Attorney General Spitzer and our legislators respond. Close quote. The poll covered five areas of related interest. Iraq. Do New Yorkers think that our leaders deliberately misled us before the war? 51.2% do. The 9/11 Commission. Did it answer all the important questions? Only 36% said yes. The inexplicable and largely unreported collapse of the third WTC skyscraper on 9/11. What was its number? 28% of New York City area residents knew. 9/11truth.org is a coalition of researchers, journalists, and victim family members working to expose and resolve the hundreds of critical questions still swirling around 9/11. Especially the nearly 400 questions that the Family Steering Committee filed with the 9/11 Commission, which they fought to create. Initially welcomed by the commissioners as a roadmap for their inquiry, these queries cut to the heart of the 9/11 crimes and accountability. Specifically, they raised the central issues of motive, means, and cui bono, who profited. But the Commission ignored the majority of these questions, opting only to explore system failures, miscommunications, and incompetence. The victims' families' most incisive issues remain unaddressed to this day. On September 9th and 11th, 9/11truth.org will sponsor two large successive inquiries in New York City, a preliminary 9/11 Citizens Commission hearing, and Confronting the Evidence, 9/11 and the Search for Truth, a research-focused evidentiary forum. These inquiries will examine many of the 9/11 Commission's shunned questions and discuss preparation of a probable cause complaint demanding a grand jury and criminal investigation from the New York Attorney General. Possible charges range from criminal negligence and gross dereliction of duty to foreknowledge, complicity, and subsequent obstruction of justice. For details and developments, see 9/11truth.org. This is the latest phase of a process that has included two previous citizen inquiries held in San Francisco last March and in Toronto in May. Tonight, I'm going to play you some of the material from the Toronto inquiry.
Soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black vest. No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from the east.
The front pages of the dailies in Toronto this morning are prime exhibits proving the need for this inquiry and its vital significance. Here they are, the Globe and Mail. U.S. hunts Canadians in Al-Qaeda attack plot. Here's the National Post. Canadians sought in Qaeda plot. Finally, the Toronto Star. Al-Qaeda plans to hit U.S. hard. These headlines comprise, in my opinion, classic evidence of the need to get to the bottom of what really happened on 9/11. And that is the purpose of this inquiry and phase one that preceded this one in San Francisco at the end of March, and phase three that will follow in New York City in September, and others that should follow until all the truth-seeking and activism bear fruit in a politically relevant outcome. An analysis of the stories upon which those headlines are based and the decisions by senior editors of these papers to make these their top front page stories this morning could be the subject of a full session or a full day of this inquiry. And here's why. The reality of these headlines and the reality of a chain of authority-based top-down communications, which almost guarantee that claims by the Bushites continue to be converted into allegedly authoritative news, all this is enabled by a mindset, an acceptance of the reality of the so-called war on terrorism by most or all of those all down that chain. And these headlines can be construed as the notching up of the fiction that Canada is, quote, a haven for terrorists, and seen as possible black ops meddling in the Canadian federal election. They maintain chronic low-level anxiety, and it's specifically, in this case, increasingly targeted at Canada, because James Woolsey, the former CIA chief, made a speech in Calgary about a month ago along these same lines. It has the marks. There's a pattern to it. These headlines certainly show, at least, that the official story of the events of 9/11 remains in the mainstream to this day, 2 years and 8 months later, the linchpin of the so-called war on terrorism, a phrase that these papers, and all too many people altogether, continue to use without quotation marks, thus accepting the so-called war on terrorism as an unvarnished reality. And even an initial analysis of these stories, on the face of them, justifies, to my mind, a great deal of skepticism about the alleged substance underlying the claims of FBI head Robert Mueller and U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, all dutifully and seriously amplified by the subservient, skepticism-challenged stenographers at these papers and their endorsing editors. Well, when I reached this point in preparing my welcoming remarks to you this morning, welcome to phase two of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11. I realize that the rest will have to be integrated into my own presentation tomorrow at the same time. So it's with a mixture of anger and some pride that I welcome you to phase two of the International Inquiry into 9/11. Anger at the continuing unfolding of a world of state-sponsored, mainstream media-manufactured, fear-fomenting illusion, and pride that we are providing a support system and a platform, a haven, if you will, for 9/11 skeptics and anyone interested in 9/11 truth and all its ramifications and the consequences of failing to reveal it. And I have pride in sharing this platform with American colleagues, especially this morning, Carol Brouillet, the spark plug of phase one in San Francisco, and pride that this inquiry is providing a platform for Rocco Galati just 2 hours from now. Only the Globe and Mail this morning managed to include any thoughtful Canadian response to the Mueller-Ashcroft claims, and Rocco was one of those quoted. He got 4 words. Stick around for a few thousand more well-chosen words when Rocco takes this stage 2 hours from now. Now, I assume each of you is more interested in substance over generalized welcoming, and I want to make way right now and leave maximum time for Carol Brouillet, and a special particular welcome to her and to all of you, to the rest of the program today and through this increasingly substantial inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. I'm supposed to report on phase one, and I must say that Phase One was born out of the grassroots, on the streets, on the internet efforts of many, many people who refused to believe the big lie. Several people foresaw 9/11 and tried to prevent it. Alex Jones, on his television show in July 2001, told people to call their congressmen and tell them that if there was a terrorist attack, people flying airplanes into buildings like the World Trade Center, we would know who was responsible. The U.S. government, who brought us Waco, the Oklahoma City bombing, the World Trade Center attacks in 93. Unfortunately, not enough people made enough noise to prevent the attacks. I felt shock, disbelief, horror that surreal day, which ominously was chosen to be a turning point in history, a day to change the rules of human conduct and heralding a new age of terror and fear. "You're either with us or against us," said Bush, not leaving much room for those people of peace who do not believe in war and fighting. The terrorist attacks paved the way for the construction of a new global security state, a new level of cooperation and integration of intelligence and police agencies worldwide. At the same time, legislation loosely defined terrorist as anyone opposed to government or corporate policies. The horror I felt on September 11th was compounded by the media, which immediately began beating the drums of war. I overcame my deepest fears and flew to Washington, D.C. to march in three anti-war rallies, to lobby my representatives, and learn that the war in Afghanistan had nothing to do with fighting terrorism, but a lot to do with oil, crushing dissent, and geopolitics. The official narrative about 9/11 was never proven in a court of law. There's been no solid evidence presented other than the bizarre passport which flew out of the hijacker's back pocket, escaping the inferno intact to land conveniently in the rubble where authorities could find it, and a suspicious tale of blundering footprints and fake bin Laden videos. Not only was the Patriot Act bulldozed through a terrorized Congress, but parallel legislation was crafted and pushed through in Canada, England, and in other countries. On January 8, 2002, about 40 of us marched on Senator Feinstein's office, where a delegation representing many peace and human rights organizations demanded a congressional investigation of 9/11. We raised a large number of questions. Afterwards, Bush and Cheney asked Daschle to limit the investigations. The Joint House-Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee, which conducted the official inquiry, was overseen by the very men who, on the morning of September 11th, were breakfasting with a prime suspect, Pakistan's head of the ISI, Lieutenant General Mahmoud Ahmad, who had 100,000 wired to Mohammed Atta, whom the FBI identified as the lead hijacker. The chairman of these committees, Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss, were the very men who should have been investigated. A simple analysis of the inquiry and the subsequent commission, which were very much opposed by the Bush administration and only came into being because of the valiant efforts of the victims' families, reveals that both the inquiry and the commission assume that the official narrative is true and that their mission is to justify the expansion of the military intelligence agencies, the creation of Homeland Security, at the expense of our Constitution, the Bill of Rights. The New York Truth, 9/11 Truth, has produced a pamphlet entitled Scamming America, the Official 9/11 Cover-Up Guide, which is a scathing condemnation of the King Commission, which has utterly failed to address the key questions to former Mayor Giuliano last week, much to the outrage of the victims' families. Those families want the truth. In fact, I think all of us want the truth. The Bush administration has been caught lying on more than one occasion about 9/11. They've used 9/11 flagrantly to sell war. The most outrageous conspiracy theory of all is that Saddam Hussein had something to do with al-Qaeda in 9/11. And Cheney continues to spout this without a shred of evidence. The pivotal earth-shattering event of 9/11 was a crime against humanity, which the Bush administration has used to launch a crusade. We must ask ourselves, who had the motive, the means to commit, and the ability to cover up a crime of this scale? In the wake of 9/11, investigators were prevented from having access to the crime scenes. Evidence was destroyed systemically and shrouded in the veils of secrecy and national security. Clearly, the people of Afghanistan, Iraq, have been killed, maimed, and are suffering terribly from military actions launched by my government. And the American people are paying the price. And companies that profit from war, like Halliburton, are the ones making the fortunes. Not buying the lies nor the competing incompetence theories is the 9/11 truth movement. There are literally thousands of websites about 9/11 and a growing community of researchers, authors, activists, journalists, artists who believe that our best hope for the future is to discover the truth about 9/11, share our findings with the public, and hold those responsible for 9/11 accountable. The purpose of the San Francisco International Inquiry into 9/11 Phase 1 was to help shatter the big lies about 9/11 with the most obvious truths that the media, Congress, have failed to acknowledge and investigate. The inquiry drew 150 registered participants, 25 media representatives, dozens of filmmakers, and the published purchased over 750 daily tickets. We collected over 50 hours of video and are producing a number of documentaries. Some of them are posted online, and many have been shown here in the past 2 days. Phase one was also an organizing opportunity for those of us who have been doing the research. It was the first time for many of us to physically actually meet and dialogue, strategize, collaborate, discover that we're part of a growing movement. The 9/11 Truth Movement has produced a number of films and documentaries. I think Barry's The Great Deception is still the best one that we have actually on 9/11, although many, many have been made. Books, pamphlets, radio programs, art, music, and lots of unanswered questions. And while the questions remain unanswered, the time has come to draw attention, I think, to the unexplained facts that the government and the press really want to ignore. We can prove that the U.S. government officials have lied, have destroyed evidence, and are involved in a massive cover-up. By their own admission, terrorist alerts and scares have been used for political reasons, and we see that in today's headlines. Clearly, the war on terrorism is actually a war of terrorism against the people of the United States and the world, and people must organize resistance faster than they can organize repression. I believe that 9/11 was a desperate act on the part of a global elite to cling to power using their traditional methods of terror and war. They couldn't have attempted such a feat without the collusion of the media, which continues, you know, to this day. The psychological warfare is bombarding us continually, assuring us another attack is imminent, that terrorists can't resist the opportunity that the G8 summit, the Democratic Convention, the Republican Convention provide. At every mobilization against war, the World Trade Organization, the FTAA, the IMF, the World Bank, and the World Economic Forum, officials are always trying to frighten people with violence to scare them away. In Seattle, at the protest against the WTO, and more recently, in Miami at the protest against the FTAA, the violence is almost exclusively that of the police and their undercover agents against the ever-growing numbers of peaceful, enlightened public who see the government and growing corporate power as a threat to our freedoms, our health, the air, the water, the food, the environment, and every aspect of human life. It's time to merge the growing global justice movement, the anti-corporate globalization movement, the anti-war movement, the 9/11 truth movement, with a deeper understanding of who is responsible for the worst terrorist acts, the wars that follow, and the systemic oppression and exploitation of people and planet. At the grassroots, in the streets, the message is restore democracy, impeach Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, at least in the United States. I don't expect you Canadians to do that. I don't think you can affect our government, but obviously your government is following suit, and they need to hear from you to know that you don't want to support their collusion with the U.S. government. On Friday morning of the inquiry, which was the opening morning before the public, before the press arrived, the consensus amongst the actual researchers and the activists was to endorse impeachment to make it part of our suggested actions afterwards. The resistance to impeachment comes from Congress, and you can even the Congress people who were trying to encourage the impeachment movement to gather signatures, etc., they have chickened out. They're trying to discourage people from pressuring them to impeachment now. And I think it is because Congress is under tremendous pressure from the White House. They're being terrorized as well. And the only enormous pressure at the grassroots level will spur Congress to do the right thing. There's an old saying that when people fear their government, there is tyranny. And when government fears the people, there's freedom. I believe it's the highest duty of a citizen to hold their government accountable for their crimes. And that imperative continually grows more urgent as the sheer criminality of their actions becomes blatantly obvious. And this requires courage on the part of the public to speak truth and demand accountability. And I thank all of you for being here and hope that together our movement for truth and peace, justice, life will prevail. And I hope One of the things that's very different about phase one and from phase two is phase one, Ninka, I think, unjustly characterized it as being organized mainly by me. It was just the efforts of such an enormous number of volunteers. We had 70 or 80 volunteers who'd put in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 hours during the conference to help make it work, as well as, you know, hundreds of hours of research building up to the inquiry. And I really want to acknowledge the fact that all these volunteers, all the people who are dedicating their lives to trying to break the story, I think they're drawn together by just this incredible purpose, the clarity that they really want to serve life, and they think that this horrendous crime, the people who perpetrated it, should never be allowed to get away with it and then use it to just terrorize the rest of the world into going along with their horrific agenda, which we see marked by what's happened in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the way they keep changing the 9/11 story to help them to justify a war against Saudi Arabia, Iran, any other country that they could use the terrorist threat to build any sort of support to attack any country. And what we did in San Francisco was we had our main presentations, and additionally we had rooms on the second floor of the Herbst Theater where organizers and researchers could self-organize and just get together, whoops, and meet and pursue different lines of inquiry. And I must say that the self-organizing part was a surprise to me. I was hoping that we would be able to present our major findings to the public on Sunday afternoon, but we had so many documentary filmmakers doing interviews and panels and creating studios upstairs that the actual getting down to the hardcore research and putting heads together, we just didn't seem to have time to do that at phase one. And the new findings that we had hoped to present to the public, we didn't really present them. We sort of reiterated our main points because we felt that the big questions still hadn't reached broken through the mainstream press, and the public were still unaware of the possibility that there might have been stand down orders that day, that there was something wrong, that no planes were intercepted, just the really basic ABCs of 9/11. So we try to reemphasize those points on Sunday afternoon rather than go into the latest research. But there has been a tremendous amount of work that has been done, looking particularly at the war games that took place on September 11th, that The commission hasn't mentioned, hasn't looked into, and there are serious concerns by the 9/11 truth movement that we are being set up also for another terrorist attack, and that if we don't alert the public to the modus operandi of the government of creating the patsies for their next terror attacks, that it can certainly happen again. And we can see the buildup and the preparation right now for the United States to launch another terrorist attack, to disrupt the elections, to declare military law, to cling to power. And I don't lie awake at night biting my fingernails over the terrorist attacks, just simply because at this point I'm somewhat immune to them. They've been actually trying to terrorize us since September 11th. The continual drumbeat of the mainstream press has been one wave after another of ominous threats of imminent terrorist attack. The cover of Time magazine, you know, where do you store your gas mask to be prepared for the next biological attack? This has been going on for 2 years. The flashing yellow alert, the orange alert when you go through the airports. After a while, you just can't let, I can't let fear overrun my life. And but I do think that it's something that we need to be aware of, and that there is a real imperative to expose this as soon as possible for the sake of everyone. And I would like to now introduce Ian Woods, who is going to talk about the official story. And again, I thank you all for being here.
Carol Bruyer, organizer of the 9/11 Citizens Inquiry, Phase 1, held last winter in San Francisco. Our next speaker is Canadian journalist Ian Woods, co-editor of Global Outlook magazine.
First of all, I'd like to thank the people that helped put this official story together, briefly. John McCurdy, who's a fabulous researcher. You might have seen some of his emails on the internet. He basically compiled about 40 or 50 pages of this. And then Steve Moore from out in BC, who's also a researcher and historian and a writer for Global Outlook, he synthesized it down to about 20 pages, and then we took it from there, and then Jennifer Hopp and I put together the PowerPoint presentation so that it was a little bit easier to comprehend and do it within 15 minutes. Okay, let's start. This is the official story of what happened on 9/11 according to the U.S. government. Now, in order to give an overview, I went to the internet and I looked at the World IQ Dictionary and Encyclopedia, and here's how they have now defined September the 11th according to the so-called internet dictionary. The story, part one, there's four parts to this, is that on September the 11th, attacks were a series of coordinated terrorist suicide attacks against the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. The first highly lethal attack on the U.S. mainland since 1814, with a death toll of nearly 3,000, the attacks exceeded 2,400 dead following the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, which provoked the U.S. into World War II in 1941. And by the way, these anomalies, or not anomalies, but this part of the official story, what we're doing with our panel is trying to poke holes in the official story, find out where it's a complete fabrication. So as you're going through this, you'll see how the government official story that we're putting up is going to be criticized by the panel and by you and by the speakers to show how big a lie it really is. Part two, the attacks involved the hijacking of four commercial airliners with some nearly 24,000 gallons of jet fuel aboard the aircraft. The aircraft were, in fact, flying bombs. Two aircraft were flown into the Twin Towers, one into the Pentagon, and the final aircraft crashing into a Pennsylvania field. A number of important buildings were destroyed or severely damaged. Part three of the story, according to the dictionary, is shortly after the U.S. government blamed Al-Qaeda, a fundamentalist Islamic organization. This led to the War on Terrorism that included the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in October of 2001 and had a major influence on the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Part four, in the aftermath, you can see Tom Ridge there in the picture, the U.S. government increased pressure on accused terrorist groups as well as governments or countries that harbored them. The attacks also precipitated a focus on domestic security, creation of a new cabinet-level federal agency, the Department of Homeland Security. And there's the man in charge of it with his red, yellow, and orange code alerts. This, according to our researcher John McCurdy, in his words, in general, the immediate aftermath of the attacks, the out-of-the-blue narrative was the dominant official 9/11 narrative, stating that not just ordinary Americans, but the entire U.S. government was taken entirely by surprise on the morning of September the 11th. For example, we have Condoleezza Rice. How many people are fans of hers? Thank you. Asked if she should have known about it, she said, there are always shards of intelligence and different kinds of analysis. I mean, how do you stack it up against hundreds of reports about car bombs? So I wouldn't make that claim. And these are all quoted in the mainstream press now. So this is how the official story is getting relayed to us. Out of the blue, Dick Cheney. Vice President Dick Cheney has admitted that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon caught U.S. officials by surprise. And then CENTCOM. Yesterday's attacks caught a vast security apparatus off guard. The military command center in Colorado, responsible for U.S. air defenses, received word just 10 minutes after the first aircraft struck the World Trade Center that an American plane had been hijacked. The notification came too late for fighter jets to take action, a senior Air Force officer said. Robert Mueller, director of the FBI. On Monday, 17th of September, FBI Director Mueller insisted the agency had no warning signs of last week's attacks. Intelligence failure. According to the Fifth Estate, the Canadian program, the U.S. intelligence community and the Joint Inquiry Investigation into the Failure of Intelligence admit that they had an enormous amount of evidence and information that an attack was in the works, and even had some of the hijackers and their helpers under surveillance at various times. But, say this information was lost in the general mountain of intelligence gathered on a regular basis. George Tenet, the director of the CIA. Let me begin by characterizing the 9/11 plot in broad terms. First, the plot was professionally conceived and executed. It showed patience, thoughtfulness, and expertise. Al-Qaeda leaders deliberately chose young men. They received the money they needed through ordinary wire transfers, generally in small enough amounts that they did not attract attention. What about that $100,000, though? Intelligence failure, completely caught off guard. The colossal intelligence failure, this again to John McCurdy and myself, it's not a quote from a paper, but the colossal intelligence failure in the hijacker bin Laden Al-Qaeda narrative was front and center from the very beginning, and somehow the so-called terrorists outwitted the $30 billion a year U.S. intelligence apparatus, catching the U.S. Air Force, Department of Defense, NORAD, and the Federal Aviation Authority completely off guard. Then we have Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism advisor. If the Bush White House had heeded warnings in early 2001 about the threat of Al-Qaeda, at least two of the hijackers would probably have been caught, and there was a chance the attacks could have been prevented. Pearl Harbor. Now again, this is John McCurdy talking. Constant comparisons of the 9/11 attacks were made to those of the so-called surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. Here it is right here, Colin Powell. The parallels with Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, which brought America into the Second World War, have been widely drawn, and there had been no credible warning. Kamikazes. Until last week, nobody had confronted the possibility that a terrorist hijacker might turn kamikaze pilot. herded to the back of the plane by hijackers armed with knives and box cutters, the passengers were ordered to call relatives to say they were about to die. That in the Washington Post. Two commercial airliners were hijacked, and each was flown into one of the two 100-story towers. The structural damage sustained by each tower from the impact, combined with the ensuing fires, resulted in the total collapse of each building. This by FEMA, which is the government-regulated Federal Emergency Management Agency. The disaster began to unfold at 8:48 when American Airlines Flight 11, carrying 92 people from Boston to Los Angeles, crashed into the North Tower of WTC 18 minutes later. United Airlines Flight 175, carrying 65 people on the same Boston to LA route, tore through the South Tower with an even larger explosion. Those in charge of emergency response at the World Trade Center never imagined the building, designed to survive the impact of an air crash, could collapse, but the terrorists used aircraft bound for West Coast and laden with fuel. They, the crashing aircraft, generated such heat when they exploded that steel girders supporting the building melted. Collapse was so unthinkable that the fire department's command center was set up too close and was crushed when the buildings fell, killing senior officers. The FEMA study did not reveal any specific features that would be regarded as substandard, and in fact, many structural and fire protection features of the design and construction were found to be superior to the minimum code requirements. The collapse of these structures is particularly significant in that, prior to the events, no protected steel-framed building had ever experienced fire-induced collapse. That, according to the government, FEMA. Details on this collapse will probably be sealed in far into the future, because they did actually examine this, and almost certainly the most sophisticated and complete understanding of exactly how and why the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center fell has been compiled as part of a largely secret proceeding in federal court in Lower Manhattan, developed by some of the nation's most respected engineering minds. Everyone from structural engineers to relatives of victims fear that the information, which includes possible answers, may remain buried in sealed files or even destroyed. Then you get on to the World Trade Center Building 7, collapsed completely after burning unchecked for approximately 7 hours. The FEMA report concluded, without further substantiation, that the specifics of the fires in WTC 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. According to the report, the reason for the collapse of the tower could not be definitely determined. Then we get on to Flight 77, carrying 64 people from Dulles to LA, barreled into the west wing of the Pentagon in yet another fiery collision, destroying at least 4 of the 5 rings that encircle the world's largest office building. But just as the plane seemed to be on a suicide mission into the White House, the unidentified pilot executed a pivot so tight that it reminded observers of a fighter jet maneuver. The plane, circling 270 degrees to the right to approach the Pentagon from the west, whereupon Flight 77 fell below radar level, vanishing from controller screens, the sources said. Flight 77 carved a hole in the nation's defense headquarters, a hole 5 stories high and 200 feet wide. Flight 93, officials soon confirmed that a fourth plane, Flight 93, carrying 45 people from Newark to San Francisco, had crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It had been hijacked as well. One passenger called 911 from a cell phone and had been heading toward Washington when it went down. The only successful action against the hijackers was taken by passengers of the fourth airliner, whose heroic decision to fight back led to its crashing into the fields of Pennsylvania. Now, because I'm running out of time, I'm going to have to flip through the next ones just quickly and get to this. Within a few minutes, the Bush administration had determined who had done it. Osama bin Laden from a cave some 12,000 miles away. 15 of the 19 hijackers were apparently from Saudi Arabia. America's leaders seem increasingly convinced that Osama bin Laden was responsible. He is one of the very few terrorists with the organizational power to carry out such an operation. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mastermind of the September 11 attacks, has told American interrogators that he first discussed the plot with bin Laden in 1996 and that the original plan called for hijacking 5 commercial jets on each U.S. coast before it modified several times. 6 chartered flights that rushed scores of Saudi citizens out of the U.S. after the attacks on 9/11 were handled properly by the Bush administration, the independent commission investigating the attack said in a statement. The FBI had concluded that no one who was allowed to depart was wanted for questioning and that the commission found no evidence to contradict this. The United States president and his allies accused critics of undermining the war on terrorism by suggesting that he could have done more to thwart the attacks. And that, in summary, is the official story of what happened on 9/11. Thank you.
Ian Woods, co-editor of Global Outlook magazine, speaking in Toronto last May at the Citizens' Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11. This is Unwelcome Guests, where we've been covering the question of government complicity in the 9/11 attacks since March of 2002. If we can do it on a budget of zero, what's the corporate media's excuse? You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KFAR Knoxville 90.9, or Free Radio Olympia 91.3. We return to the speakers from Phase 2 of the Citizens' Inquiry into the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, held last May in Toronto. Carol Bruyere introduces the next speaker.
And I have the honor and privilege of introducing Michelle Chasudowski, who I must say has been a hero of mine for many years. I have his essays posted on my website, and it was his emails and his discoveries about who was Osama bin Laden and the links between the head of Pakistani intelligence and top U.S. government officials which prompted me to action. I wouldn't have done anything that I had done if it wasn't for Michelle and his outstanding research. Michelle Chasudowski is a professor of economics and international development at the University of Ottawa and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He's taught as visiting professor at academic institutions in Western Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific. He has acted as economic advisor to governments of developing countries and has worked as a consultant for several international organizations, including the UNDP, the ILO, the UNPF, the WHO, and the African Development Bank. He is a contributor to the Encyclopedia Britannica. His writings have been translated into more than 20 languages. He's the author of the international bestseller, The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, which was published in 11 languages. He's the recipient of several literary awards. His most recent book, published in 9 languages, is entitled War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th. He is the recipient of the 2003 Human Rights Prize of the Society for the Protection of Civil Rights and Human Dignity in Berlin, Germany. He is also co-editor of Global Outlook magazine. His website, Global Research, was granted the Democracy Media Award in 2002, 2003, and 2004 by Good Writers Net. And in 2004, Michelle Chasudowski was invited to present the underlying issues pertaining to the U.S. war agenda and 9/11 at a special session of the European Parliament in Brussels. Please welcome Michelle Chasudowski.
Well, I'm delighted to be here at this very critical juncture in our history. The news this morning is very, or yesterday morning is very disturbing, because it suggests and it indicates that the Bush administration, in effect, is preparing for martial law. It's not the critics who are saying that, they themselves are saying it. They have already embarked upon terrorist exercises. That was done, in fact, almost a year ago in May of last year. And in fact, Canadian government agencies participated in these so-called terrorist exercises. You also may have heard the statements of Anne McClellan, who is the copy and paste, I shouldn't say quite, because she's not the same sex of Tom Ridge, but she's a copy and paste version of Tom Ridge, and she runs Canada's Homeland Security Department, which is the rank of, and she has the rank of a cabinet minister and deputy prime minister. So you can understand the extent of these cleavages. Bear in mind that Anne McClelland, in her press conference, actually, which was aired live yesterday afternoon, said that they will be consulting with intelligence agencies in the United States, Britain, and Australia, which is the new axis, the new Anglo-American axis. I think we have to, and this is also, I think, something which the press should be confronted with, that when these terrorist warnings occur, they have a responsibility to at least question the validity as to whether these terrorist warnings are genuine or not. And you might have heard the statements by Ashcroft, which were aired profusely over CNN in the last 12 hours, they are specific as well as non-specific indications from incredible multiple intelligence sources that there will be a 9/11 too. It's a bit like Home Alone 2. It's a new concept of having Mark 2. You know, that we've had Mark 1. We're going to have a second 9/11. They are saying, prepare yourself for a second 9/11 before the November 2 elections, and they say they have credible evidence. I haven't had the time to start doing the research, but I have absolutely clear evidence that they are lying in relation to previous terrorist warnings. And I'd like to share that right at the outset of this presentation. One, when Colin Powell made his flop presentation to the United Nations Security Council in February 6th of 2003, of last year, in other words, in the month leading up to the war, the following day, on the 7th, there was an orange code alert in the United States. And Colin Powell said, Osama bin Laden is going to attack America using a radioactive bomb, okay? Now, if you followed that, and we did very careful research on it, it turned out to be fabricated, okay? People started getting very nervous. It's a bit like in Monty Python, Fear and Surprise, the Spanish Inquisition. Well, I can tell you, I looked into it, and I'd like to quote the ABC report on that, because the FBI actually accused the CIA of fabricating intelligence. We are not accusing. The FBI said, and I quote, according to U.S. officials, the FBI and the CIA are pointing fingers at each other. An FBI spokesperson told ABC News today he was, quote, not familiar with the scenario, but not think it was accurate. While Homeland Security acknowledges that the intelligence was fabricated, and they said, and I quote again from the report, despite the fabricated evidence, there are no plans to change the threat level. Officials said other intelligence has been validated, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that was back in February of last year. Fabricated terror alert. Now, a fabricated terror alert, from my point of view, is criminal. Okay? Let's call it by its name. People from America lived through the Christmas holidays, and there were terror alerts all over the place, right? Remember? The terror alert was on the 21st of December of last year. Okay? Now, that terror alert was fabricated. And it is not the researchers who are saying that, it is the police investigators who actually corroborated that Tom Ridge fabricated the terror alert. And I'd like to give you just a couple of again, a couple of quotes on that, because it's so important to refute these fabric, to show and exhibit the fact that these terror alerts are fabricated, because essentially fabricating terror alerts is the prelude to implementing Red Code Alert. And when you go to Red Code Alert, quote, you close down the country. That's what Tom Ridge said back in December. He said, if we simply go to red, that basically shuts down the country. And that means we suspend civilian institutions and we go into an emergency mode. People who have done research on that know it. It's very, very clear. But what happened on December 21st? There were reports that there were a number of Al-Qaeda operatives which were boarding Air France flights into Los Angeles. People from Southern California know it because the whole place was swarming with roadblocks. What happened was that these six Al-Qaeda men turned out, when the French police investigators produced their report on December 23rd, okay, in collaboration with their U.S. counterparts, it turned out, and this may sound funny, but it isn't funny, the six Al-Qaeda men turned out to be a five-year-old boy, an elderly Chinese lady who used to run a restaurant in Paris, a Welsh insurance salesman, and three French nationals. Now, that information was available on the 23rd of December, and Tom Ridge sat on it until the end of the Christmas holiday to maintain the terror alert at Code Orange. So that, again, in those two high-key terror alerts in recent history, February the 7th and December the 21st, there is evidence from police sources that these terror alerts were fabricated. And I suspect that I don't see much credibility behind the recent terror alerts, but I also see the scenario. They're asking people now to report people who might look like these six persons. Two of them are Canadians. There are reports about Canadian aircrafts going into U.S. buildings. I think that this information, of course, raises serious issues. But bear in mind that underlying all these threats and underlying the official story of 9/11 is Al-Qaeda. Because ultimately, what is never mentioned in any of the press reports is that Al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA. Okay? That the outside enemy of America is there to attack us. He is an outside enemy. There were forewarnings, etc., etc. In fact, that issue is now being shoved to the background. Al-Qaeda is an intelligence asset of the U.S. government consistently since the Soviet-Afghan war. We know it. We've documented it. Some people say, of course, even the intelligence community are saying, oh, Osama went against us. We helped him during the Soviet-Afghan war to liberate Afghanistan. He went against us. I tell you, no, that is not what happened. Because we have the evidence of Al-Qaeda collaboration with the U.S. government right up until August 2001. And that is ultimately the big lie. And just following just a sequel on Ian's presentation of the official narrative. Where was Osama on September 11th? Well, I'll tell you where he was. He wasn't in a cave in Afghanistan. He was in a military hospital in Rawalpindi, Pakistan,